Roguecast is the official podcast of Rogues Gallery Comics and Games. Every week we talk about new comic releases, the latest geek culture news, and whatever movies, TV, and other pop culture is on our radar for the week. I'm Randy.
This is Dave.
I'm Nick.
And now, on with the show.
Welcome to Roguecast number 175. It's a huge, pretentious number. It's a number 25 is a big thing in the comics industry, right?
Yes, and did we achieve this number by adding together a bunch of weird miniseries? And
we need to go back and add in the numbers of our Comic Pants podcast.
Yes, then we can truly be Marvel style. wait! Y'all have done individual podcasts.
That's
too.
True.
Let's add those in there. This podcast number like 472. Actually,
yep, you're right.
I'm sure it's way beyond that. We did a lot.
Yeah, Comic Pants, Geek Bombast.
Yeah, that's right. And you know,
Randy, go ahead and throw your TV stuff
dudes.
In.
Yeah, okay.
That'll add like 500 shows right there.
Welcome to Roguecast Generations,
yes.
Issue number 1,512.
We actually haven't talked about the renumbering thing on Marvel in general,
did we not?
No.
Okay. Didn't we post like a?
We
like
did
how
post
Marvel
the,
is
we
doing
posted
it,
the, and I actually did think like on a general level. I like that they did that.
They thought about it. Yeah, they thought
right.
It through.
So yeah, if you guys looked on our Facebook page recently, what you might have seen, Marvel's renumbering a lot of their books, and they're going back to sort of their legacy numbers. So they're going to go back up into the hundreds and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And they showed you that they did a worksheet, which should
yeah.
tell you that something's a little kind of skeevy anyway.
There's nothing more comics than math.
When you're like, let's show how we had show your work.
Show your work.
And so it's like, well, for Hulk to be on whatever it was, it includes, you know, 370 issues of Incredible Hulk. And then, you know, 38 issues of Totally Awesome Hulk. But then it, like, they include some weird stuff in there. I'm like, some of that is dodgy inclusions. Like, I would not include Totally Awesome Hulk. I like Amadeus Cho. I might even have a related sort of pick to it on my pick this week. But that's not Banner. That's not The Incredible Hulk.
Fair. But it's All Things Hulk.
Yeah.
Anyway.
But the book is not titled All Things Hulk. It's Incredible Hulk.
That's true, but they should call it that, All Things Hulk.
Yeah, you know, I suppose often enough it's been Rick Jones
yeah.
or She-Hulk or somebody or another. Ah, whatever then.
Yeah. But it's interesting though, and I'm not a guy who wants... I don't know that anybody wants this.
Yeah.
Like, the people who want the old numbering, they want the old number. You can't get that back. They don't want this... renumbering stuff.
Marvel was diving really into the nostalgia for a lot of things.
Yeah.
Do you think it was because when DC did Rebirth, they went back to their old numbering only for Detective and Action, their most venerable
yeah.
core
See,
comics?
I think that that's what they should have done. I think they should have done Spider-Man.
FF.
And then they should have brought Fantastic Four back with Legacy numbering.
Yeah.
That would have been the same thing DC did. But neither company wants to copy each other, even though when one of them has a good idea,
yeah.
the other one is so scared of copying, they don't want to do the thing the other person did right.
But they wait about 2 years and then they copy
and then
they
it anyway.
Absolutely
yeah.
do it, yeah.
yeah. So, anyway.
Ultimately, on the numbering thing, I'm kind of neither here nor there on it. It doesn't bother me too much. I'm, you know, I'm either going to like the new stories or I'm not. And so.
I'm someone who liked the series of miniseries approach. I like having new number ones. It's easier to get new people in on number ones.
Yeah.
The only people who want big numbers are older people.
Yeah.
And they're reading it regardless. Or they're not. I don't.
Or yeah, some of them have like never again.
I don't feel like I don't know. I don't know. I don't know anybody. I don't think who really was excited to get these numbers back.
Yeah,
it's a little weird.
But the first week that they haven't begun yet.
No,
right?
No, we haven't ordered all of them yet.
Yeah, right. The first week that those appear, they may give Marvel a boost because they'll be kind of like. A little wave of buzz will run through
yeah.
people, and people may turn out for
but
it.
I think
yet.
What there's an example of like the Incredible Hulk in here. We're reading
yeah.
what? Totally Awesome Hulk number, what, 14, 15?
Yeah, yeah.
And then next month we will be reading Incredible Hulk number 709.
Yeah.
So
a little weird. I'm worried it'll be a little off-putting. But ultimately, the thing is, I'm really enjoying a lot of Marvel's books now.
Yes.
You can number them randomly and I'm going to enjoy them.
Right.
I just feel like it's a weird thing to do.
Can they do that? I actually think that
just
would be an interesting
numbers.
Interesting test.
Oh my
Didn't
God.
They do something like that with Deadpool once as
yes.
like to goof on all of that
yeah.
stuff?
Oh man. And then nobody knows what anything is.
They like did a miniseries that would like went backwards numbering
yeah.
to negative numbers
you know,
or
we,
something.
We have a numerical system for a reason, people.
Yeah.
Same reason we have an alphabet. Mm-hmm.
I have this feeling that, like, you know, in Europe where they have those numbered graphic albums and in Japan where they have these very neatly numbered long runs of manga,
mm-hmm.
they're just looking over and they're like, what are they doing? Why would you do that?
Let's be honest, Dave. There's a lot right now that Europe and Japan are looking like, what are they doing? Why would you do that?
Yes.
All right. So let's run down the store news real quick because, again, we got crazy busy months from now until forever, apparently.
Yes.
Reminder, we're doing board game nights on Tuesday nights from 6 to 9 p.m. Come in, play stuff from our library, bring your own. We didn't have a lot of turnout last week because we just announced it kind of last minute, but we're hoping to get that going. For the next few weeks, you come in, you can come say hi to me and Cliff. And then after that, you can come say hi to Cliff because I'm going to go back off working Tuesday nights.
I think you should play Pandemic and Mysterium and Formula D. Those are my three suggestions.
At the same time.
If you can, if you're cool.
Combine all the rules into one giant game.
A giant game of car racing and I can't remember which other pick was.
Pandemic Legacy.
Car racing, disease, and ghosts.
Yes, Formula Mysterious Pandemic.
Then on Saturday, we've got the demo of the Cypher system, the game Predation, which involves like dinosaurs and time travel and all that kind of stuff. And that is going to be on from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. We got room at the table for that, so come out for that. Ladies Night is again this week. It is the Queertastic Edition, and that is August 5th from 8 to 11 p.m.
Yep.
We had a good turnout for Ladies Night last week.
Yeah. By all accounts, things went really well.
Yep.
Last time closing. It was a PJ party. I believe this time it's like wear your rainbow colors, show your pride, anything you got in that ballpark.
Yep. Teal is running that for us, of course. And then the next Saturday, August 12th, from 10 a.m. to 8 p.m., we're doing our 10th anniversary. So kids stuff in the morning. We're going to do King of Tokyo demos. We have an activity book to give out. We have some limited, we have some HeroClix starter packs to give out. And then midday, we'll do a demo of the game Die in Space, which is being developed by a customer of ours. It's a card game, a dice game. It's a lot of fun.
He had good success showing it off at
RTX.
Yeah. So, and I have a feeling people are going to dig it.
Yep. And then from 6 to 8 p.m., comic book trivia.
Yep.
We're almost done with our categories.
Yep.
It's pub style, teams of four. You can either come with a team or you can come and be put on a team. We have a trophy on order.
Yep. And we have super fun questions.
Yes.
That made us laugh and amused us as we were coming up with them.
Yep.
Just a real quick aside about the HeroClix. We had, aside from the fact that we've been getting a pretty good turnout since, for a little while now, it's been nice and steady. But we, like last night, we had two families that came out that were both kind of hadn't played it in like 10 years and were just kind of curious to see what was going on. So they came out to watch and had a really good time, and just happy to see people enjoying it.
Yeah. Then on Saturday, August 19th, from 6:45 to 9 p.m., we're doing Gaming with Rogues. Hero Realms, which is the game of the month. If you have a rogue card, you get 10% off on that or any of the expansions. That's the fantasy version of Star Realms, and it's super fun.
Yes. It's instead of recruiting ships and bases and stuff, you're getting orc assassins or, fireball hurling magic users and all kinds of fun stuff like that.
Yep. Then Saturday, August 26th, from 8 p.m. to 11 p.m., after hours, just like the girls' night, is Austin Pride Party. That is, Teal is sort of throwing that too. That is for everybody, not just the lady identifying, but everybody to come out, whether you're gay, whether you're just an ally, come out and
wherever you hit on the spectrum.
Celebrate the tail end of Austin Pride with us on that Saturday.
Yep.
And by us, I mean everybody. I actually had previous plans, so I won't be there.
I think I'm going to be there.
But Dave will be there.
Yep.
And Teal will be there.
Yep.
And possibly Honor and possibly Cliff. We don't know.
Yep.
And Staple is coming up. That is Saturday, September 9th and Sunday, September 10th. There's a bunch of cool guests. Hope Larson's going to be there this year. Kyle Starks, who we'll be talking about a little later. I forget who all is going to be there, plus all the local creators. It's at a bigger place down in East Austin. It's always a good time. Glad to see that coming back. We also have free stickers to give out down in Staple now.
Yep.
So, and they're cool. They've got the the dude from Space Riders. Those guys are going to be there.
Oh, nice.
And he designed the Staple Gator, and it's like a cool sort of 80s retro video game looking sticker.
Yep, he looks sort of like a video game / He-Man character, villain, bad guy. I feel like there's a decided Trap Jaw influence.
Yeah, I see that. And then looking ahead, there's more stuff. There's Game of Thrones again in September, and there's Harley Quinn Day in September, but we'll get to that later.
Yep.
All right, news. We covered a lot of news last week, but we wanted to hit a few things this week. Supernatural is doing a spinoff called Wayward Sisters, which features a bunch of female characters who, Dave, you and I have never actually seen.
Right, I am way too far behind to know any of this stuff. Supernatural is... Have they announced their end date?
No.
They're
continuing. What season are they on?
13. They're coming up on season 13.
Okay.
About to have a crossover with Scooby-Doo.
Glad to have a crossover with Scooby-Doo. They're getting crazy. They're already popular. Might as well try some weird experimental stuff. But this is pretty big. They have never expanded the series as successful as it's been.
No, I think it's gained so much in the realm of popularity that they finally can do a spinoff.
You know what's funny is, like, among my diehard Supernatural friends that I see on Facebook and social media and stuff, there seems to be an agreement that the show has maybe gone on too long. Like, some of them are still watching it, some of them are enjoying it, some are watching it on momentum a little bit.
Yep.
So I don't know if, like, the show maybe shouldn't do this.
I don't know. CW has had good luck with spinoff, though. I mean, Arrow obviously spun off a ton of shows.
And it's clearly a quality show. Like, I've seen enough to know it's a great show. So, you know, I wish him luck. So I hope it's good.
The deal with this is that it's going to get a backdoor pilot episode. It's expected to. They don't really know. This is kind of early. This is a story from Screen Rant, so we don't know how accurate it is. But they're saying that it's maybe going to get a backdoor pilot episode and then possibly get a show. So this has not been confirmed in any way. But it's Sheriff Jody Mills, who I don't know.
She's been around. She shows up in later seasons, but...
Claire Novak, who is the daughter of Castiel's human vessel. Alex Jones, the unfortunately named Alex Jones, who was rescued from the control of a vampire nest that was using her as bait. I guess they've been living with Jody as foster daughters. And they're introducing a new psychic named Patience Turner, who is related to estranged grandmother Missouri Mosley from the one-off character from season one.
Yeah,
I don't remember, but I know I saw her.
Oh, yeah, she was the one who lived in their hometown.
Okay.
That basically foretold, like, their mother's or mother's death and that their father went saw. Yeah.
So, like, a character with a brief appearance, but who probably actually was pretty powerful or notable in her in her time.
And I actually recognize most of those characters. They're all from not early in the show, but probably midway.
So they're not just making stuff up.
No, pretty cool.
Matt Groening has announced that he's doing a new series on Netflix called Disenchantment, aimed at viewings for fantasy, what Futurama did for sci-fi.
That's pretty big.
Yeah, it's it takes the viewers to the Kingdom of Dreamland. Hard-drinking young Princess Bean, voiced by Abby Jacobson from Broad City. An elf named Elfo, voiced by Nat Faxon. And her own personal demon, Lucy, voiced by Eric Andre. Those are all good actors. They're all very funny people. And basically it's them going on quests in this fantasy world.
Honestly. Sounds like his opportunity to lampoon everything, I'm sure, from Lord of the Rings to D&D to every single other fantasy labyrinth, I'm sure.
You had my attention at Matt Groening at this point.
I was thinking earlier, on Futurama in particular, it seems like there were a lot of D&D references. Aside from, like, the disembodied head of Gary Gygax.
Yeah.
I just feel like D&D turned up a lot on that. It got occasionally referenced, like, on Simpsons, like when Homer went back to college and played D&D with the nerds, and that was fantastic, because he's when he's describing his adventure the next day to somebody, he's like, we stayed up all night playing Dungeons & Dragons, and then I was slain by an elf. there was always some underlying love. There was no doubt about it, and kind of cool to see him completely running with it.
Yeah, I'm excited to see this. I haven't even watched all of Futurama. I've only watched bits and pieces of.
But it's kind
of
rare. I'm like, is that in Simpsons the only two major shows he's produced?
I feel like, I'm sure he's done some other stuff, but yeah.
But those are the ones that bear his stamp.
Well, and the thing is,
and so this is, I mean, like, what, every decade or so, maybe he launches a show?
Well, and there's always, like, the people running Futurama and the people running Simpsons were notable comedy people who have gone on to other things. I mean, Conan O'Brien, for example.
Right.
David, you know, Sam Simon, David X. Cohen. There's a whole bunch of other names. Yeah. So Groening gets the lion's share of attention because he creates it, but he always surrounds himself
great
with people.
Yep.
Yeah. So this is supposed to hit Netflix in 2018. So I'm excited for it. We've got Wonder Woman 2. Last time we talked, did not have an official release date. It now does. Release date is December 13th, 2019.
So. It's a little farther out than I might have thought, actually.
Yeah, they're trying to launch their whole cinematic universe, so you know.
Lots of scrambling to probably try it. They're like, make it more like Wonder Woman quick. can she be in all the movies? Can she be the Flash?
Yeah.
I feel like they should have their own flavor, even though I know the joke that you're making is true.
I just feel like, I actually think they are wisely looking to it probably mainly for tone.
My guess is that a lot of Clueless executives at Warner Brothers are like, oh, this worked, why did this work? And that they're trying to deconstruct it, and they're not going to be very successful at it because they have no idea why this was successful.
Right? They will like wrongly decide it's just because women are trendy right now or something like that, and not because it was well written and sincere and had a strong non-sexualized female character and a lot of different reasons that came together. Hopefully there will be enough voices of reason in there or strong directorial visions to maybe balance that out.
I just hope Justice League isn't a garbage fire. That's all I want.
We'll see.
I don't think it will be.
I do.
The Randy of last week was so enthused for the trailer.
No, I wasn't.
No, he wasn't. That was me. He was like, it was awful.
No, I've never been enthused for Justice League. I've been it doesn't look as bad as I feared it has. That's as far as I've gone.
That's practically making love to it.
It is for me.
I mean, DC does have its problems, so I can't be completely... But I feel like Justice League will do better than a dumpster fire.
But one problem it doesn't have is it's not losing its Batman. Ooh, segue.
That's true.
At least we think.
Well, yeah. Ben Affleck has signed on to appear as Batman in the Matt Reeves trilogy. So the guy doing Batman is now doing a trilogy. And supposedly a Batman Beyond adaptation. So the plan is Affleck will play Batman in 3 movies, and then he'll play Bruce Wayne in a Batman Beyond movie.
I could see it.
That's ambitious.
Here's the thing, like, we've at least seen it done. They basically, that is what Robert Downey, that's the role he's going to fall into. Sure. He's going to end up being the, he's going to end up weirdly being the venerable guy.
Yep.
You're right, DC, of course, it's much more up in the air, but as a plan, I like it. I mean, I actually liked Affleck as Batman, and I kind of didn't expect to, but I thought he was good.
I thought he was both
Batman v Superman.
Good as Bruce and as Batman.
Yeah,
so
I agree.
This is interesting.
But there was like, it was weird. It's like a week ago, people, like, the word was he definitely wasn't going to do any of this. And everybody was like, he's trying to get out. He's trying to get out of his contract.
Guys.
Yeah?
Did he get out of his contract? There's an editorial note at the end of this that says, since this article has been published, it has been proven to be completely false.
Oh, my God.
BatmanNews.com, which also not a great source, says, no, Ben Affleck did not sign for a Batman trilogy and the Batman movie. Oh. It has not happened.
Wow, easy come, easy go, I guess.
That was a South African fan site.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Wow. That one traveled around quite a bit.
See, I didn't think that was true, but you guys were like, no, it's out there.
Yeah.
Well, goes to show you can't believe everything on the internet.
I should have looked before we posted. That's hilarious. At the end of it, it's like, here's a note. Oh, by the way, this whole story you just read, it's false.
What's funny is I think, I don't keep up closely with the movie news like that, but I think I saw a few friends share it.
Yeah.
And like, if enough friends share something, I go ahead and presume some veracity.
This is how we get to fake news, guys. So that is not true, and Ben Affleck may in fact be out after one movie.
Were he to stick around, I would be happy. And were he to play craggy old Bruce in Batman Beyond, which he's already getting a little older, then I'd be down with it.
I remain indifferent. Indifferent to hostile. So we got a little bit of news on Flash Season 4. We saw a trailer from San Diego. But they have cast a man named Hartley Sawyer. Do not know who that is.
I never know who any of their people are, really.
He's been on Glory Days, DAZ, and The Young and the Restless, as well as the critically acclaimed short film Spin.
See, sort of handsome guy in the same vein as the dude who played, like, Jay Garrick and stuff.
Yeah, pretty much.
But he will be playing the Elongated Man.
The Elongated Man.
Who, if you, this is a somewhat obscure DC knowledge, but that he it began, that Elongated Man was a backup feature, I think, in Flash Comics back in the day.
Yeah.
But he also, I think, was supposed to know Flash, so they're kind of supposed to be buddies.
He's also a huge, I mean, he's an actual detective.
Right, he's a detective who, depending on the iteration, sometimes does detective stuff on his own, sometimes it's kind of with his wife, and sort of a Thin Man homage to, Nick and Nora from the Thin Man movies.
Yep. It'd be awesome if they could... kind of
I would love it if they
that.
Did them if he was introduced as a married
I agree
guy.
I don't think they're going to because not that's CW can be married on the CW you have to be you're,
right
have to be young
he's
going to
be
fresh.
A romantic lead for somebody will fall for him,
but that's too bad because I would really like him to be the Nick and Nora of him is what makes him interesting to me.
They could set that up You know, it would be kind of interesting if he was, like, at odds with another detective, like a female detective that they were working with. Like, yeah. She's the official one, and he's the kind of amateur detective.
Yeah.
And their methods are completely different, but they end up falling for each other. Yeah,
that'd be interesting.
I think we don't know any plot stuff. We only know he's going to be in there.
Well, we also
is he going to have his powers, or is he just going to be a detective right
yes,
now?
Yes, he gets his powers. They're not going to do the Gengold juice. I'm sure.
Probably a good idea.
It's probably going to be he's a metahuman from, but we don't know. Yeah. But he should have his powers. Yes.
You know, he should drink some soda called Gengold juice or it's something true. Like that.
He should be a guy who made his own makes his own sodas. there's also we know that Clifford DeVoe. A.K.A. The Thinker. And that's The Thinker from Suicide Squad, by the way.
Oh, okay.
Is going to be the big bad for the season.
So not somebody who runs fast.
Not somebody who runs fast. And he's accompanied by someone playing the mechanic, his right-hand villain. I don't know who that is. And this is kind of fun. Danny Trejo is joining the show as Breacher, a feared Earth-19 bounty hunter who also happens to be Gypsy's father.
That's sounds like fun.
Awesome. I need to catch up. I didn't watch the last, I don't know, 6, 8, 10 episodes of Flash this season, so...
I actually thought it... I did. I went back just recently and watched it all, and yeah. I found the third season to be pretty good.
Yeah, I need to catch up. I was liking it off and on. I just... the last week I spent catching up with Rick and Morty instead. sort of some big news from the animation world. Andrea Romano is retiring. Now, you may not know who Andrea Romano is. You may. Listening to this podcast, you might know that name. But she is the voiceover and casting director for Animaniacs, the original DuckTales, the DCU original movies, Avatar Last Airbender, not to mention all the Dini Timverse.
They did Batman the Animated Series, Justice League, yep. Justice League Unlimited, Superman.
Batman Beyond.
Basically, if you enjoyed an action cartoon, and also, like, not just action, Animaniacs yep. and stuff like that, if you enjoyed a cartoon in about the last 30 years,
yep.
chances are a good that she was part of the reason it was great.
Yeah, she also voice cast Teen Titans.
Yeah.
Her most recent work is the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and Nickelodeon and Voltron Legendary Defender, which starts up here in August. So,
basically, the yep. best of the best...
Yep.
At what she does,
yep.
and what she does is actually very pretty. a few of her inspired voice casting bits over the years. I mean, obviously, Kevin Conroy as Batman, or Mark Hamill as Joker,
yeah.
like iconic versions. People are always talking about how these are in many ways their most definitive version ever.
Yep.
But I also, you know, there's the crazy ones, or there's cool ones like, what's his name, David Warner as Ra's al Ghul.
Yep.
Who's the guy who did Mr. Freeze?
Oh, I don't remember.
He was kind name. Of a small, yeah. Smaller niche genre actor from, like, the old Outer Limits and stuff like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, but it was perfect.
That was perfect. Famously,
Ed Asner
as Granny Goodness.
Yeah. And this is all just casting. She also directed a lot of these episodes as far as directing the voice direction.
Right, right.
So, like, a lot of those performances, those come from Andrea Romano.
Well, if you look at other stuff going on in the 90s, even stuff that was pretty good, like the X-Men cartoons, you'll hear that they were kind of enacted in a very theatrical, larger-than-life way.
Dave.
Yes. Then you watch something like Mr. Freeze, by the way, Michael Ansara, that was name of the guy.
Yep.
You watch the episode with him, or you see any serious exchange on any of those shows she did, and you're like, man, this is a new level of voice acting.
Yeah.
This is a level of subtlety and nuance and depth to the characters that had not previously been seen.
Yep.
So she's going to be missed.
Yes, she is. So I saw a lot of friends posting about this one. The Nightmare Before Christmas is getting a comic that continues.
I think it's coming out through
It's coming out through Tokyo Pop, which makes me nervous.
Yeah.
But
you're nervous because Tokyo Pop disappeared or whatever.
Abandoned the comics market and nearly crashed the manga market.
Yes. Yeah. But that doesn't say anything as to the quality of these manga outings.
No. So it is. It's going to be a serialized full color single issues, and then it's going to collect in full color trades and black and white pocket sized manga volumes.
It's weird to do, both color editions and
there's
black and white ones like that.
There's a huge audience. You and I both, we know this from looking at the previews catalogs. There's a huge audience for Nightmare Before Christmas.
Yeah. for a movie that I believe it's known, I mean, basically, it kind of came out, it had sort of, I think, essentially cult success initially, but became huge in the years to come. So, like, now it's a pretty well-loved movie.
Yeah.
But, and yeah, all this merchandise that was not available in the early years when it came out, is there's just tons of stuff. Like, it's a merchandise machine, and especially there's, like, seem to be endless super expensive and really nice Japanese like stuff that we don't order for the store because, you know, you don't necessarily want a $300 set of Lock, Shock, and Barrel or whatever. but there, believe me, there's some great stuff out there for them. But yes, we haven't had like any sort of sequel to it, though, I think, at all.
No. Which is kind of crazy.
Yeah, I think I read somewhere this is the first time I think that Tim Burton has kind of opened up the license like that, which led them to wonder, will there be subsequent things? Is he considering a sequel? Or, you know, might this show up in other media? Is there going to be a cartoon? Is there going to be, who knows?
I have a pitch.
Yeah?
Nightmare Before Labor Day.
Huh?
Yeah.
Oh. Well, they have access to all the other holiday worlds.
Yeah.
That was like a big thing in the movie. So, yep. I mean, Jack visiting... whatever
Labor Day
Thanksgiving apparently Labor Day is Labor Day really desired.
Nobody's done enough Labor Day movies.
I want Boxing Day. Can we do Boxing Day?
Night Before Boxing Day.
Guy Fawkes Day.
Night Before Guy Fawkes Day.
But just came up with the idea. I mean, did he write it and Henry Selick
directed it?
It
was based on a poem he wrote in the early 80s that was like kind of a little macabre poem, I think. And
was
I believe
an AC team? Was it written in a little Death notebook?
Of course it was. I know that at some point I think they took that initial thing and turned it into like, he did like a little children's book. I think right when the movie came out, they released that slightly different version. And then, of course, the movie was its own thing. But these will be like new adventures of Jack Skellington
and Sally
and all those. And the weirdest thing to me is, of course, that the movie is a musical.
Yeah.
And this will not be able to run with that.
What if they use that greeting card technology where you open it and the music pops out?
Sounds great. I mean, as big a part as it is of the movie, I think you can tell a story with these fairly beloved characters at this point and not need it.
I was just going to say the music is amazing.
It is. It'll be weird to hear it without his voice. He was the singing voice and speaking voice, or was somebody else the speaking voice?
I think he was both, actually, if I remember correctly.
Yeah. You know what's interesting is that this is one of those projects that would be perfect for like an anthology where you do different stories of like the various characters, and like a story. I can see a story focusing on like the mayor, who is this really interesting character, like the jolly mayor, that kind of thing. Like little short stories. Like, I'm surprised that this is going through Tokyopop and not the Disney comics they're doing, like the Pirates and Frozen and Disney Princesses.
I do think I'd probably have more faith in those guys.
Yeah. Well, they've been doing really interesting stuff, and I'm surprised that this wound up at. Maybe because Nightmare Before Christmas was adapted by Tokyopop, maybe they had first rights to the rights.
I don't know how active Tokyopop is in Japan or if they're just an American company, but it may have something to do with the extreme seeming popularity of Nightmare Before Christmas in Japan.
It's possible. Yeah, they might have easier distribution in Japan.
Yeah.
That's possible. All right. So that's our news for the week. We'll be back in just a second to talk about comics. We're talking comics for Wednesday, August 2nd, and I'm going to start off, because this was a great week for me. I actually, like, I think everything you guys picked in general I really liked. I had, like, 8 potential picks, and so this was a really good week for comics. And the one I picked is Dead of Winter number 1 from Oni Press. It's written by Kyle Starks, who's been doing the Hobo Adventure comic Rock Candy Mountain, Rick and Morty, and did the 80s adventure comic graphic novel Sex Castle.
He seems to have some twisted sensibilities, which, and I don't know if we said this yet, but Dead of Winter is a board game.
Yes, it is. This is illustrated and colored by Gabo Bautista.
Okay.
And Gabo, of course, makes me think of Gabo from this.
To me, he's just Gabo.
Yeah. But, this is based on the action, this is based on the board game Dead of Winter, and I don't know if Kyle Starks is a fan of the board game, or if the notes he got were just really good, but as someone who really likes the board game, he nailed the feel of it. Like, it is not... This is not a, like, dire zombie comic. It is not super dark.
And just in brief, like, if you don't know the board game, it's a sort of a zombie survival, like, you're in a it's like a little colony or whatever, right? And you're trying to survive the winter.
You're trying to survive the winter and zombies. Yes.
Yeah.
It's a co-op board game. But basically, you don't need to know anything about the board game to play this. If you do, right, you'll get some nods.
But you feel like he kind of nailed what it.
He did a good
job.
The tone is right because it's not a dire zombie comic. It's not like lots of murder, but nor is it like goofy. It's got a sense of humor, but the zombies are an actual threat. The lead character is Sparky the Wonder Dog, but it's not played just for laughs, even though it is kind of fun. There's a running gag about how much the dog hates zombies. There's little things where whenever a character shows up as one of the characters, there's a little dialogue box that indicates who they are. So it's like, Gabriel Diaz, fireman. Ruckus Burley, white trash. And that is their role in the game.
I was going to ask, are those actual characters from the board
game?
Yes. Okay.
Anyone that had a name, like Arthur Thurston Principal, that is a character you play in the game. And they have their abilities in the game give them a sort of personality. And so he definitely built on that. And so it is, you know, the same thing I liked about, say, Afterlife with Archie, where the selling point was that it was well-drawn characters in a zombie apocalypse.
Yeah.
Same thing here. There's well-drawn characters and... seeing them deal with zombie apocalypse. Same people like about Walking Dead is the character work. Now, it just happens that in this particular case, it's Sparky the Wonder Dog is one of the characters.
And I will say, he is my favorite character in the entire book.
He's great. But
now, when you say he's the lead character, does this dog have thought balloons?
No.
Nope.
We're actually seeing other people react to him, but he's definitely the guy driving the action.
It's a dog in a cape.
It's a dog in a cape. It's really, really good. And if you have any fondness for zombie comics or for board games turned into comics, which I don't think is a thing, but apparently might be now.
Well, we've talked about how good the Clue book is.
That's right. Yeah.
Wouldn't you read a pandemic comic?
I would read the hell out of a pandemic comic.
Yep.
I mean, I think that would.
I would also read a Settlers of Catan comic.
Mysterium.
Yeah.
Comic.
Mm-hmm.
Ticket to Ride? I could see a fun Ticket to Ride where it's like all the people like going different places. Or maybe you do it about the magnates like making the routes, something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
Star Realms has novels you've been reading.
Yep.
They can do comics. There's all kinds of board games turning comics.
Saying, this is the next thing to
adapt. Yep. The next frontier.
Right. If they continue this tradition, they're already doing better than the tradition of, say, video game movies.
That's actually true. And video game comics, let's be honest.
Yeah, that's true.
Dave, what's your pick?
Alright, my pick is a very fun Pacific Rim-esque comic called Mech Cadet U. That's Y-U, like the Japanese name.
Not Y-O-U, like you. Mech Cadet.
There's a new book from Boom Studios that's very much rooted in that sort of anime tradition of sort of big mech robots versus aliens. And they present a Voltron, stuff like that.
Yeah.
They present a history where this giant mech came from space, what was it, 60 years ago, as of this futuristic setting. And it's like futuristic, but not wildly futuristic.
No, no.
You know, it's, I guess, a little bit like Robotech kind of ish.
Yeah, people still eat food instead of food cubes.
Right, right.
there aren't any replicators that make.
Yeah, and this military guy at the beginning looks like a traditional military guy.
Yeah.
Anyway, the mech bonded with a kid, and it turns out that was part of a sort of process that they do to help defend the world, you know, threatened worlds from these aliens called the Sharg. And so they went on to, it was the deal that every 4 years, group of these robots arrives, and they've got this program called the Sky Corps where they kind of recruit people to meet them or whatever.
Yeah,
and to be selected.
They train them to sort of become pilots for these mechs. Like,
right.
It's almost like a bonding ceremony.
Yep.
Yeah.
Early on, the camera, as it were, is kind of panning across all these eager young cadet faces, and you see this one kid whose name is Stanford, Stanford U. You realize the camera pulls back and reveals he's like the janitor kid standing behind all of the kids in the auditorium seats. And his mom is his mom, right? Yeah, it looks like she's sort of like the head janitorial services person. And this guy is like pined to be a pilot. You can see the anime tropes at work here.
Yeah.
He's, you know, the guy who always wished he could be selected and never was. And believe it or not, this kid is going to end up in a mech before things are done.
This also has a little Iron Giant to it.
Yeah,
there's some Iron Giant. The designs are a little bit more Iron Giant than traditional mech suits, although there's some of that in Voltron to it as well.
By the way, you're underselling one, I think the biggest thing of is this, which is the creative team.
Right. So, yeah, we got Greg Pak in here, who's a lot of you guys know him best for his Hulk work. He did Planet Hulk and World War Hulk, probably the two best-known Hulk stories of like the last 10 or 20 years.
He's also writing the awesome Weapon X right now.
Yep, he's writing Weapon X. And then the artist on this is Takeshi Miyazawa, who did some issues of Runaways back in the day. He did Spider-Man Loves Mary Jane.
And notably, he and Pak have worked together a couple times. Once on a thing that, once a graphic novel that was inspired by Jonathan Coulton songs called Code Monkey Save World.
Oh, that's right.
But notably, they were the two that created Amadeus Cho.
Right. Cool robots, great character designs, all the stuff you would expect from Miyazawa. He's one of those... His art is just always, you know, like, there's no flawed panels in here. Yeah. It is all nicely done. Great futuristic setting. And I feel like the people who are going to most like this are people who are like the new Voltron.
Yeah.
There's a bit of Pacific Rim to it, but it's not quite as gritty as all that.
Right.
Or at least not as weird. It has more in common with Voltron. But beyond just the kind of the loser kid gets the robot, there's some more going on. There's some more behind the scenes sort of character drama going on and melodrama.
Well, I think your Voltron comparison is dumb because Voltron is one of those things that we all expected to be kind of the cheesy cartoon.
Right.
And there's a lot more to it.
Right. You worry that it's like, it's just the tropes, whatever.
Yeah.
And then you see it and you're like, oh, man, this is like really good.
Yeah.
Now, this is if you are ready for that, then, and there's even like a good cool surprise on the last page, some cool, you know, setting up new other stuff.
Dave?
Yeah.
What is it?
I'll say it.
No, don't say it.
I'm gonna say it. Anyway, so Mech Cadet U, number one. Check it out. Nick?
I also have another issue number one. This one from Image Comics. It is entitled Elsewhere, which new book by Jay Farber and drawn by Sumey Kezgin.
It's a Turkish artist that he ran across online and was like, I need to do a book with this person.
Oh, that's actually really cool. Yeah. I love the artwork. It's very exciting and dramatic and just sort of just fun as well. But
Trevor's done a good job finding artists, whether it was for this or
Copperhead. Yeah, so,
let's do the elevator pitch.
So the elevator pitch is, what if Amelia Earhart ended up in a fantasy land?
Yeah.
By the way, I've seen, like, is it the anniversary of her disappearance or something like that?
Something like that. There was a photo that came out of the baby show that she, like...
Might have ended up in, like, a prison camp or something like that, but...
It was never confirmed.
I believe that's correct. So it remains one of those mysteries, and, she's shown up in Star Trek.
Yeah.
They found her in Star Trek, and so she's become a popular figure, and, you know, no wonder you've got this, you know, this famous, adventurous hero, especially a female hero at a time when the world wasn't really quite ready for that, maybe.
Yeah, but she shows up in this fantasy world.
But yes, no, Farber has it right. She popped into an alternate fantasy world where she gets dropped into amongst two guys who are escaping from a citadel of doom.
It's
just like a D&D type fantasy world.
Yeah, a little bit like that. They've got flying bugs and things that kind of resemble dragons.
Okay,
and...
but a little bit more inventive than just like you landed in Lord of the Rings.
Exactly. Right. There's definitely more world building that Farber does in this, and it's both him and the artist get this kind of flesh things out really, really well, which I appreciated. But I also liked these two guys that she runs into.
Yeah,
aren't the typical people you expect in a fantasy world, and their banter is fun, and they're apparently part of some rebellion against an evil dictator.
Although they seem to mostly want out.
Yeah, I mean, they just want out.
And the bad guys present is very omnipresent. Like, it is the bad guys have won kind of world.
And then they come across Amelia Earhart, and she's about what you expect her to be, very kind of...
Plucky.
Plucky, and they don't know quite what to make of... For one, she's a human. They don't know what that is.
I would imagine in a world that feels like it's basically been beaten by the bad guys, plucky is not what you expect.
Yeah.
Well, even that, they do have sort of a sense of humor.
Right.
So, I mean, it's not as dour as all of that.
Right, no, it's not like Seven against, or Seven to Eternity,
which is
a very dour comic.
There's a much more upbeat tone to it than Seven to Eternity, yeah,
Fermer tends to write a little bit lighter than that.
Yeah, but, I mean, and of course you would... I might expect that there are many things that occur after that. I don't want to spoil anything because there's some fun stuff Amelia Earhart being who she is.
There's also a big twist at the end that I won't give away, but which also expands out the possibilities of the comic.
Which I thought was really cool.
That, I was already on board this thing, and then when I got to that end, I'm like, oh, I really want to see where they're going with this.
But there's a splash page in here that thought is amazing work from the artists depicting these kind of floating islands amidst a sky and moon, and it's just really, really cool. Kind of reminds us something about like Final Fantasy and things like that.
Yeah, they always had the kind of more inventive landscapes and not just castles and things.
So honestly, if you've liked anything that Fermer's done, be it from Dynamo 5 and Noble Causes,
but especially Copperhead, which I think a lot of people really liked.
I definitely think you're going to enjoy this one as well.
They also do say in the afternotes, because this has been an issue with some of Fermer's books, it's going to be done as a series of 4-issue arcs. Then I could take a month off and do 4 issues and take a month off. So it's he's all prone to the scheduling.
I appreciate
he's trying
that.
Out the Brian Vaughn kind of technique.
Vaughn.
Yeah, it's a modified Vaughn, a little bit tighter.
Yeah.
Which I appreciate because sometimes he kind of does get lost a little bit.
And by the way, speaking of, I believe Vaughn said some really nice things about this. So did some other writers. It's got a lot of comic writers really liked this.
Yeah.
I feel like Fermer's one of these secrets. I mean, he's working in TV and stuff, but I feel like he's one of these secrets of the industry. A lot of people don't necessarily know his name, but he's been doing good comics for a long
time.
Didn't
he showrun something for Netflix?
He works on Zoo.
Zoo, that's right.
Nick, while you were flipping through that, I saw the twist ending thing or the surprise reveal, which I don't want to say. I won't say anything about other than, that's super cool.
Dave. What is it? See, we're going to run into this thing where you're running a joke and you'll just tell us.
This close to doing
it's this.
So my backup pick is something I think Randy has picked most every issue.
A lot of them, yes.
And that is X-Men Gold. This is issue number 9. Guggenheim is still in the driver's seat. Ken Lashley's doing the artwork. And this tells the tale of sort of Kitty goes to Washington.
Miss Pride goes to Washington.
Yes. Colossus tags along as sort of a bodyguard. And honestly, this is sort of a character piece about them and also Nightcrawler and Rachel Summers.
Yeah. They contrast the two of their sort of older romance with newer romance, and it works really well.
And Guggenheim, it's a very fun way to do those two relationships.
Now, why, just real quick, why is Kitty going to Washington? She's testifying or something?
She gets asked to talk with the Senate Oversight Committee about them. Basically, the United States wants to kick all of mutants out.
A sort of mutant ban.
Mutant ban. And she gets...
I don't know how to relate to this, but I'll try my best.
Yep. Yeah, it seems completely implausible.
And Guggenheim does some fun callbacks to Kitty's history with a character showing up. If you know...
That was one of my favorite things. That's one of the things they've done in X-Men Gold is they nod to old characters. They definitely play with the history a little bit.
Is this the one that y'all told me about?
Yeah.
Yeah, this is one of those things where it's a character we haven't seen in a while and a use of them that I'm like... It's sort of rare to have this feeling where I'm like, the way they use this character sounds like a perfect version of where that character would have ended up.
Yep, and X-Men Gold is really
not one of those things where I like hear about it and I'm like, oh, they became a supervillain or something like that, or just something, you know, predictable.
Yeah.
I'm like, no, that is a very smart continuation of that character.
Yep.
And for me, it's kind of a weird thing to say, but, you know, with X-Men, you want generally giant, big action and things like that. I kind of like the more smaller character moments. So getting to see, like, Nightcrawler on a date, that's a fun little thing.
That was always the fun part of X-Men. But there is a throwdown in
There is a throwdown.
I was going to say, Claremont did kind of invent the downtime issue, but his downtime issues, you know, always still did have something else going on.
Yeah, this isn't Bendis style where it's just people talking for 30 pages.
No, it's completely in the vein of like what Claremont has done in the past.
It'd be like, Nightcrawler is taking a sabbatical from the team, but he ends up hanging out with that stunt woman and, you know, running from Dr. Doom or something like that would happen.
And there are definitely threats running throughout the issue. Multiple ones, in fact. So,
what are they?
I will say this, they're all Russian.
Actually, yeah, that part was kind of interesting sounding.
I'm going to start answering with spoilers from other things. Like, it's a sled.
But also leaves characters in interesting places, and I'm excited to see what Guggenheim continues to do in this book.
Yep.
So, yeah.
I remember back when this was coming out that I was very skeptical they were able to make X-Men for me, and I'm so happy to be wrong.
Guggenheim is a guy who I think has always sort of been a somewhat middle-of-the-road writer for us,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah, I was trying to remember exactly where I first remember seeing him.
He's written stuff I actively dislike. Like, he's the one who made Wolverine come back from Nitro's burst as, like, a cell.
Where he
reestablished the notion that Wolverine's healing factor works, like, if he's a cell that comes back. And I'm like, man, I hate that.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's...
He's written stuff... He's generally not written stuff I love. He's the guy who wrote that Alien Invasion comic we were trying to think of, Dave. The Oni Press one.
Which one?
Remember the Alien Invasion?
Oh.
That was Mark Guggenheim.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so yeah. That was kind of the Walking Dead of Alien Invasions. Yeah,
which,
like,
I think went nowhere.
Right.
But he's written stuff I've liked, and he's written stuff I've hated, but he's never written anything I loved until X-Men Gold.
Yeah. It seems like it's the continuation that we've wanted the X-Men to have, where it has a foot in kind of the classics, but it's not, like, obsequious and slavish in trying to imitate them.
Right.
It's just paying respect.
Yep. Dave, what's your backup pick?
My backup pick is... this is Pac Week, by the way. This is, for me, it's Greg Pak Tuesday.
Greg Pak Tuesday.
I always liked his take on the Hulk, and here he kind of kicks off the Marvel project called Generations, which is itself a lead-in to Legacy, which the short version is, it seems to be Marvel's kind of their classic heroes are returning to ultimately, I think, to operate sort of alongside, like,
yeah.
So in this one, for example, you get the classic Savage Hulk through a time travel story of sorts. Amadeus Cho, actually, do we know how he ended
he's
up?
He's basically just leaping around.
He just
and
shows
he
up.
Just...
It's a weird time travel thing. He just winds up time traveling.
I wonder if, as these series of one-shots progress, if we're going to find out a little bit more about, like, some sort of, you know, high evolutionary,
well,
or somebody is the overcome.
I think we know that there's time travel involved in all of these one-shots.
Uh-huh.
And the newer counterpart is going to end up meeting their older counterpart at some point in their lives. Because I know,
right.
Like, the Thor one has something to do with, like, when Thor was fighting Apocalypse, which happened way a long time ago in Avengers stuff.
I just hope it's not Kang. Or Immortus.
But broadly speaking, it seems like each of the Generations one-shots will have basically the current version of a character meeting the classic counterpoint.
Yeah.
And this one is Amadeus Cho, the Totally Awesome Hulk, or Totes Awesome Hulk, as I like to call him.
Totes Awesome.
Yes. Has ended up in, like, a kind of classic Savage Hulk scenario where Hulk is being pursued by General Ross and the military, and their tanks firing at him. He's in Godzilla mode.
Yep.
And if the other ones are anything like this, it seems like the goal is to have these characters interact in such a way that they kind of try and bring out what their core is, what they're about.
Right.
You know, in a weird way, it reminds me of DC's Rebirth project, where they're like, we want to get back to whatever it is that makes these characters tick and makes fans like them. So I felt like both the Savage Hulk and Cho both kind of get their due in it.
There's a weird kind of intro to the things very beginning. It's called The Vanishing Point, which we've heard bandied around online.
Have we?
I mean, I have. We haven't known what it is, but it says, an instant apart, a moment beyond, loose from the shackles of past, present, future, a place where time has no meaning, but where true insight can be gained. Make your choice, select your destination. This journey is a gift. And I feel like that's going to be sort of the running theme through all of these.
Right. The make your choice, select your destination thing is interesting because it almost sounds like they're going to be like, it's whatever character you end up wanting.
Yeah.
But ultimately, someone is going to be published and someone is not. Or they're going to find some way to... I mean, they may be finding some way to have shared books, to have multiple books. I don't know on all of these.
Nope.
Because I like Amadeus Cho a lot, and I definitely like old school Hulk a lot, I was happy to see that they were both treated well, and you kind of see them both trying to deal with problems in their own ways. Also, they're rest assured, they punch each other. They there's some straight up Hulk fighting.
I actually loved that.
Do you say Hulk smash?
Yes.
I like that Amadeus Joe is like, oh wait, I don't have to hold back with this guy, because Amadeus Joe enjoys being the Hulk.
Right.
And so his, I don't have to hold back, I can just punch the Hulk. And getting to fight the Hulk is kind of fun for him, which is not a side we usually see of Hulk battles.
Yep. And then on the more serious side, he's had trouble, was it changing lately? Is it change that he's changing, or?
I don't know.
He's, and Banner, and Banner Hulk, are, to him, it's like Hulk is a curse. It's something you try and free yourself of. And Cho is, I think, has for the first time been experiencing that. He, like, generally doesn't experience that, just the same way kind of She-Hulk usually didn't have that kind of lack of control.
Right.
And so I think both of them gain a little bit of some knowledge of, you know, why the other one, you know, what they have or their different way of thinking that kind of works for them, but also has to gain, they have to gain some respect for each other. Anyway, this plays up a lot of the kind of the classic Savage Hulk tropes of, you know, laying low, fighting the military, and, you know, trying to be a good guy when you're also a monster. I enjoyed it quite a bit. I felt like I've always felt like Greg Pak has like a really good handle on the Hulk, and wherever it ends up, I'm hoping that he might be in charge of the Hulk relaunch or whatever, because I feel like
bringing Bruce back.
Yeah,
that'd be nice.
Well, you know how in the Rebirth Green Lantern Rebirth comic, which is still one of my favorite Green Lantern stories. How that had actually all the lanterns in it, and you know, ultimately Hal ends up wearing the thing. You know, he's the main ring guy, but everybody else got their respect, and you know, especially Kyle. You know, they made a point to there's no, you know, that Hal wouldn't have been able to come back if not for Kyle and stuff like that. I feel like they might be veering towards something like that.
We'll see.
And anyway, if Greg Pak is for me the best choice for running the Hulk. What else you got, Randy?
All right. So my backup pick is a book that we don't get a lot of copies of, and in fact, this is the final issue. It's Unstoppable Wasp number 8. And it is a shame that more people didn't read this book, because it is great. The final two-parter has been about Janet Van Dyne sort of coming to the rescue of her sort of stepdaughter, I guess. She's really, I guess she'd be her stepdaughter, because she was Hank Pym's daughter. And sort of helping her put together her crew, her sort of girl science lab. And it's got a lot of great sort of emotional moments and just builds up a status quo, which unfortunately is going to have to be explored in other books because it's the book is ending because not a lot of people read it. But there are going to be two trades of the series, Unstoppable Wasp, and I feel like people should seek them out. People, if you're liking Miss Marvel, if you're liking Moon Girl and Devil Dinosaur, if you like Squirrel Girl, any of those kind of things, this is a book that you really would like, and I thought the last couple issues were as good as Miss Marvel's been for me. So I just want to sort of throw a shout out to it. It's got some really touching moments. It's got some great use of characters I really love, and it's got one of the Janet Van Dyne really gets her due in these last couple issues. So
that's interesting. I was not sure. I kind of thought that they were politely escorting her away, perhaps.
Nope. They're definitely, because she's sort of her stepmom, they were putting her in sort of a mentor role, which makes a lot of sense.
Right.
Yeah, I would like to see more of that character. I would like to see them do something with this group they established. All right. Also on my stack this week, a bunch of number ones. Robotech number one, which is Brian Wood's reimagining of Robotech. Grumpy Cat and Garfield, which is two characters who are very much alike, being very much alike. Lockjaw Dog Days, which is just a reprint project that has some interesting stuff in it. It's like a Bill Mantlow Avengers book with really nice artwork by Butch Geiss that has the Avengers vs. the Inhumans. An issue of the Inhumans miniseries that Jay Lee did that was focused on Lockjaw. Another one-shot story with Lockjaw that was Scott Lobdell's weird Marvel fanfare one that is like, you are Lockjaw. That the whole thing is done in that perspective. So if you're excited about the teleporting dog coming to TV, this is a good one-shot with some classic stories. Wanted to mention that Batman Elmer Fudd is back in stock this week.
Right.
All loved this book.
Yep, and have had many people asking about it, looking for those second prints. Well, now's your chance.
Yep. The Black Mass series Black concludes with a strong finale. Hawkeye number 9 is another great issue of Hawkeye. Sword Quest number 2, this is a weird book from Dynamite about the Atari comic that or the Atari video game that I've actually been really liking. It's very strange, but I'm digging it quite a bit. Predator Hunters number 3, Injustice number 7, and then a bunch of trades this week. So God Country gets collected. That's the Donnie Cates and Jeff Shaw story that is a complete miniseries here. I really liked it. It's got a really nice collection. Heathen, which is the lesbian Viking comic, that creator is also going to be at Staple this year, and this has been getting a lot of buzz on it. Paper Goals Volume 3, for those of you who are Brian K. Vaughan fans, or Cliff Chang fans, or both. The Grendel Tales Omnibus, which collects some of the short stories they did of the Grendel world with a bunch of different creators. So, James Robinson, Paul Grist, Steve Siegel, Teddy Christensen. There's a lot of sort of cool indie artists in this doing tales of this sort of future world of Grendels. Black Panther gets a giant oversized hardcover, collecting the first 12 issues of Ta-Nehisi Coates' run. All New, All Different Avengers gets an oversized hardcover that collects the entirety of the Wade run before it respun into Champions. And Reborn, the Mark Miller, Greg Capullo book about a woman who dies and goes in this afterlife that becomes sort of a fantasy adventure, gets a nice oversized hardcover as well. Dave, what else you got?
I don't got anything else.
Okay, Nick, what else you got?
A few issues. Batman 28, which continues the War of Jokes and Riddles. Huh? We see a battle between Deathstroke and Deadshot, which is interesting, and sort of the aftermath of it.
Stroke shot.
Yes. Champions number 11, which continues to tie in with Secret Empire and sees the champions kind of in the aftermath of the destruction of
Las Vegas. This is a great issue.
It's a great issue. It's a dark issue, but seeing those characters interact and sort of deal with the ramifications of such a horrific thing, Mark Waid is a damn good writer. There's no other words.
Yeah, Champions has been a great book, and this is a great issue of it.
Superman number 28. I haven't been reading him, but I decided to check in. Tomasi seems to have the Superman family on a road trip across America. Because I guess he's copying what Straczynski...
I think specifically they're in, like, Washington.
This issue, yes, they are in Washington.
Oh, okay. You're saying... So there he is...
It's a broader story.
I did not know that.
They're taking their RV and going across America.
Yep.
I guess mirroring sort of what Straczynski did with... what was it? Grounded?
Yeah, don't reference that.
Don't reference that. But this has basically Lois and Clark sort of teaching their son sort of about... modern history,
including it seems like from what I got skimming through it, some of the muddier areas, like how do you explain
the Korean War,
or something like that? That's kind of a because his kid is like, did we win? And they're like,
and sort of tackling those topics and sort of the ramifications and what you, I mean, how to teach people these topics.
It's interesting because you know, superhero, somebody like Superman is known for kind of his, I guess I would say, moral purity, and but tackling kind of complex questions is an interesting to see it through his voice,
and also tying into sort of Lois's history as well, because her father is, you know, a general, and you know what that brought to it. Iron Fist number 6, which continues the exploits of Danny Rand while bringing in the fantastic Shang-Chi.
I'm going to read this when the trade comes out. I'm curious to check it out.
Yeah. There was a... In celebration of sort of Jack Kirby... what is it? 100th birthday?
Yeah.
They're doing a series of one-shots featuring a lot of his favorite characters. This one is called the New Gods Special and focusing on Orion, Light Ray, and Kalibak.
Are they all... I believe they're all New Gods specials, right?
Yeah, I think they're all...
Like, there's like going to be six of them?
Yeah, they're fourth world, I guess. But yeah, this one focuses on those characters. There's a backup story by Walt Simonson.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, I couldn't quite tell from reading the solicit on this if there was any reprint material in there, and I think the only reprint material is the Kirby, one of the Kirby stories.
Yeah, there's a Kirby story at the back featuring Lonar, or introducing Lonar.
Right, who I don't know much about.
I don't either.
No.
But the fact that they decided to include that one... I wonder if it's because it's A, just like a kind of fun, unseen story, or if, like, we're going to be doing something with this character.
Possibly.
Lonar plus Batman.
But he's going to become one of the DC metal villains.
Yeah, no, he's going to be the new Robin.
Yes. But they're doing a bunch. They're doing like a Shiloh Norman one. They're doing.
I want Orion to be the new Robin. Just like he looks exactly like he is, but he has the Domino mask on.
Yes. Yeah. And they're doing a Darkseid one, which I know will be interesting. I think that one's by Scott Collins. And then I just randomly decided to check in on Justice League because why not? This is Justice League number 26. And it introduces the League's future children, which I thought was a fun concept. It's Brian Hitch, so the execution was a little touch and go, but I thought it was a fun idea, seeing all sort of these future incarnations of the Justice League's kids. So
Justice Brats.
The Justice Brats.
Not the Justice Brats, that's a German team.
Aqua Baby, Wonder Baby, Bat Baby.
Bat Baby.
Super Baby.
Super Baby.
Yes.
Psy Baby.
Arrow Baby.
Arrow Baby.
If I'm not mistaken, they're actually not babies, right?
They're not.
I made that up.
They're probably teenagers. But there are some cool
teen ones. Baby.
All right. That's all I got.
All right. We'll be back in just a second to talk about some movies. So, we all watched a bunch of movies. Or at least a movie.
Yes.
And we're going to talk about some of the movies we've seen recently. I went out and saw Atomic Blonde.
Yep.
Which I've been wanting to see since I saw the trailers. And the general vibe was good. And I greatly enjoyed this. Mm-hmm. It's based on a graphic novel, which I have not read. But we're getting back in stock this week, called Coldest City. And it is basically a spy thriller set in the closing days of the split city of Berlin in 1989. Basically, it's like the month the wall came down. So there's all this stuff. There's like protests in East Berlin. A British operative is killed. There's a list. There's always a list. People should stop making lists of their deep cover agents. But there's a list of like all the undercover agents, all these secrets, including the reveal of a British double agent known as Satchel. And it's got the true identity of this double agent. And so they bring in Charlize Theron's character, whose name I'm blanking on, to work with James McAvoy's character.
We'll call her Agent Theron.
Whose name I'm blanking on. And he is like the Berlin station chief who's sort of gone native and is like selling black market jeans and partying with the kids and wears this obnoxious fur coat and has shaved his head to sort of fit in with the punk youth of the area. And he's definitely sort of the... At one point someone's like, he's gone native, and I think John Goodman is like, he's gone feral. So the interesting thing, this all takes place, it's narrated from the point of view of like 3 days later, it's the debrief.
Oh.
And Charlize Theron is narrating to her British head of operations, who is played by Toby Jones? Is that right?
Yeah. I love that guy.
And the CIA is sitting in, and that is John Goodman.
Yeah.
And they're fairly small parts, but they're like the guy, they're the guys behind the desk.
Those are two serious character actors, though.
And she's reporting all this stuff that happened, so we're seeing her point of view, and then they'll occasionally interject and show the debriefing. And there's this whole thread running through it of who is Satchel, who's the double agent, and what all is going on here. There's also someone, there's a Stasi agent who's trying to defect and has the list, and basically someone gets killed early on who's close to Charlize Theron, and she goes in with sort of a personal agenda. But she's also this sort of badass spy, improvising hand-to-hand combat. So there's all these great fight sequences you've seen in the trailers.
Yeah.
But amongst all the sort of cool action and spectacular 80s music, which would have been great for me if nothing else, the soundtrack is fantastic. It's got a great look, and it's this sort of twisty Cold War espionage story. There's definitely more to this story. It is not just a framework on which to hang a bunch of action sequences. It's a story.
I will say, I assumed it was a framework on which to hang a bunch of action sequences.
It is.
Which I'm not wholly against, but...
No, this is... I mean, the action is spectacular, but the heart of the story is all about sort of loyalty and what spies do and the sort of the nature of the Cold War and having enemies who aren't not openly your enemies, but you all know your enemies and that kind of thing. It's got some really great character stuff. It's got a really interesting plot, and I was very, very blown away with it. This is one of my favorite movies I've seen this year. So I definitely recommend people go out and see this. Nick, you were going to talk about a couple movies you saw.
Yeah, no, I was randomly searching all of my streaming services because I was bored, and I came across a couple of movies on Amazon Prime. One was called The Girl with All the Gifts,
yeah,
which I remember people talking about it. I know it was a novel. Yeah. And it was written by Mike Carey. So if you've
read... Oh, really?
Yeah.
I keep forgetting that.
Yeah, if you've read Lucifer or The Unwritten, you've experienced...
You have some Mike Carey knowledge.
Yeah. Mike Carey's also written a ton of novels.
Like detective novels
and stuff.
Yeah.
And things like that.
Yeah, I believe a pretty successful novelist.
Yes. But this one sort of tells about a post-apocalyptic world where zombies have kind of taken over and... They're called Hungries, and it's sort of this...
A very British.
Yeah, I know, right? It definitely takes place in England.
We call them Daft Chompers.
But they actually explain a lot of things and explain what the zombie thing is. It's like this weird fungus that takes over your body and sort of in interesting ways.
It's like the stuff?
It's kind of like the stuff now.
Actually, I imagine he was probably somewhat inspired by the ant thing. Yeah, there's a fungus that makes those, what they, you know, dub zombie ants for clickbait articles.
Yeah.
But it does seem to, like, basically it rewires their brain so that it does stuff that's helpful to the fungus and not to the ant.
But the movie has a lot of in common with the video game Last of Us. I think some of, like, their zombie and sort of the way they... take those zombies in directions that's kind of mirrored in Last of Us, which is kind of creepy.
What I remember from the trailer for this was a bunch of, like, I guess school kids that were being taught, and they were, like, chained to their desks because I guess they were beginning to zombie up. Is that the same movie?
It's the same movie, but you...
Like, somebody went got close to one of them and it, like, all freaked out.
Your explanation is not right because the kids are all zombies.
Uh-huh.
They're are zombie-esque because... They were basically
the... Is this a commentary on millennials?
No, they were... Mothers were impregnated and then contracted the virus.
Uh-huh.
So their babies are sort of like thinking like...
Essentially born with
the zombie thing, but they're able to have sort of human emotion.
Okay.
So it all sort of focuses on one young kid and her trying to find her place in this world while being both... zombie and human at the same time.
Interesting.
Does she get a lot of presents for Christmas? Is that what the story title is about?
No. But it also hinges on sort of Glenn Close, who plays a major role as sort of a scientist, who's a little bit ruthless and sort of in her kind of quest to find a cure for this. It is a dark movie. There's not much happiness involved. There's also another character actor that has been in a lot of the Edgar Wright films. He was in, like, At World's End and a bunch of a lot of the other Simon Pegg stuff.
Huh. Is it tonally similar to anything, Nick?
28 Days Later.
Okay.
It's sort of got that kind of bleakness, but it's not, like, to the point where I'm, like, wanting to shoot myself.
Right.
The story it's being told is...
But it sounds like it's a little bit more of a character thing, where 28 Days Later is also pretty hardcore survivalist suspense.
There's also definitely an element of survivalist as well.
I'll check it out. I like kind of zombie movies that bring something new to the table, and like, I liked Train to Busan, but that was just kind of a few, like, lighter elements, like, it had to do with kind of how zombies sense people and stuff like that. But it sounds like this is more of a kind of thoughtful, like, how does the whole thing work?
Yeah. I honestly am getting a little tired of zombies.
Yeah.
And I know that's a sacrilege to say in this day and age.
No, I think a lot of people are a little bit tired, but there are good iterations out there.
Yeah,
like, usually people have a few versions that they like.
I'm always happy when somebody brings something new to the table. And the other movie I found was a kind of out-of-left-field movie called Miss Sloane, which... stars Jessica Chastain as sort of a lobbyist. She's like the go-to person that you want on your... whatever you're trying to pass, you want her to help pass
that. Like, Thank You for Smoking?
Yes, by way of The Insider.
Okay.
So it's got sort of a darker tone. And she gets involved with anti-gun lobbying, and she sort of takes that as a stance and kind of runs with it. And going up against... you would imagine the gun lobby who can throw enough money at the problem to make things go away. There's a lot of twists and turns, but the cast involved in this movie, John Lithgow, Sam Waterston, Allison Pill,
Sam Waterston, is he the guy from Newsroom and stuff like that? Yeah.
Was this a later movie? Because he died recently, didn't he? I thought Sam Waterston died.
I don't think so.
No, that was...
Did his character die in the Newsroom, and that's what I'm thinking of?
I don't think he died. He had a heart attack in the newsroom.
I thought he died.
I don't think he died.
Okay.
Viewers, write in and let us know. Is Sam Waterston alive?
He was also, Sam Waterston was also in Law & Order for the longest time as the head DA. But this story all sort of falls onto Jessica Chastain's ability to be this kind of non-human character because she's completely and utterly flawed as a human being. She doesn't know how, she doesn't know how to cope with things, but she's strategically plays chess. She's smart at what she does, but she has no like life.
Right.
And it's, and the way she does it, she's an amazing actress, and this might be one of the my favorite things I've ever seen her in. And the story went in places I wasn't expecting and surprised me, which I'm always happy about. But this is on Amazon Prime, so if you've got that, it's free. I definitely recommend both of these movies. Try them out.
Sam Waterston is still alive.
I kind of thought he
so
was.
You guys are aware. Sam Waterston is alive. Good news. I feel like Charlie Skinner, his character in the newsroom, died in the end.
Oh, did he? I don't remember, because while I remember the first part of Newsroom extremely well...
Yes, he died.
I don't remember the finale all that much.
Nick, I'm going to segue real quick from on a Jessica Chastain note to a movie I saw a week or two ago that's sort of drama, not quite the thing we usually cover here, so I'm just going to mention it in passing, but she was in a movie... Have you ever seen this movie called Take Shelter? Kind of strayed across it randomly.
Is that Michael Shannon?
Yes.
Yes, I did see that.
And I thought he was really... He's amazing in it,
he's
actually.
Always good.
It's kind of a tour de force for him.
I confused that with Gimme Shelter, which was the Rolling Stones biopic.
No relation.
Yes.
He's a guy who's like sort of a foreman kind of guy, like a fairly high-placed construction guy in what looks like West Texas or something like that, or Oklahoma. And... They're making decent money, and they need it for... They've got sort of a special needs daughter who's... she's deaf, and I think also needs surgeries and stuff like that. And they seem like a good couple that's doing all right, but he's having these very troublesome dreams. This is kind of what drew me to check it out, because he has these dreams of these big storms, like big, you know, giant, like, cloud fronts and supercells and stuff like that. And he cannot... they're starting to affect his daily life. Like, he can't sleep. He actually, while he's waking, he hears thunder and stuff like that. And then a ways into the movie, you come to find out that there's this sort of history of mental illness in his family, and that he is essentially likely experiencing some sort of early onset of it.
Okay.
So more than anything, it's like kind of a really fierce character study about kind of coming a family that's like, there's no bad guy here, but everybody is struggling to sort of figure out what's going on with him. And it's a suspenseful movie in its way, but it's mostly kind of a somewhat sad movie.
Yeah.
It was also really exceptionally done, I thought, and amazing acting from Michael Shannon.
Well, and there's the director of that who also wrote it is Jeff Nichols, which he recently did Midnight Special, but he also did a movie called Mud, and
I always wanted to see that.
And they all sort of have that sort of feel, the sort of very character centric pieces. Mm. I mean, he's getting broader.
I'm going to try and make a point to see a little bit more of his stuff, I think.
But, yeah, I remember watching Take Shelter. I knew nothing about it, and it was a very affecting piece.
Mm-hmm.
But Michael Shannon is one of those actors that is
I haven't seen him in a lot, other than, like, playing villains and stuff in Superman. And that's not really a showcase for... I mean, like, he was a good villain. In fact, he was arguably the most interesting character in that movie.
Yeah.
But it's not a great showcase for him. This was a great showcase for him.
He's also one of those people that kind of falls into the background sometimes. He kind of falls into the role and you forget that that's actually...
He has this kind of particular West Texas stoicism in the movie where, like, he's doing so much acting just with his face in this and his expressions... that it's shockingly impressive. But the movie I was going to actually mention was a movie called The Autopsy of Jane Doe.
Yep.
A horror movie from, I guess it's the last year or so. I think it came out in 2016. Might have been 2017. That I remember being kind of advertised sort of at indie places, like at the Draft House and stuff like that. And I thought it was going to be actually a little more indie than it was.
As it happens,
although it was an unusual concept that I had never seen before. It's actually somewhat fairly mainstream. I think it's very approachable. But there's a father and son. They're basically they're a family run. What do you call it? A mortuary?
Okay.
Or is that where you have like you do autopsies and things like that though too for the sheriff? Or is it just it's like a morgue? I guess, but. It seems right.
I guess in a small town you might combine.
Or are morgues just in mortuaries? It's clearly a long-running family business, and they definitely look check out like mysterious deaths and things like that. Mm-hmm. Work with the sheriff, and the sheriff basically he comes in with a weird. There was a house where multiple people were found dead, and a woman was found in the basement dead and like half buried in the sand. Like in the basement, naked. Like, but she doesn't seem to have any connection to all the other deaths.
Hmm.
And so the sheriff is like, I can answer the reporter's questions tomorrow on everything else that's going on in there and to make some hypothetical guesses, but I have no idea what her role in it was, and so I need you to check it out, see how she died. There's no marks on her. And what happens is, so Brian Cox, the good character actor guy, he's the father in this who has this family-run mortuary or whatever it is, and is very kind of business-like, but actually kind of a somewhat warm fatherly figure to his son, who is reluctantly following. He's probably like in college age or whatever, is learning the trade, but kind of wants to get out of it. Mm-hmm. And is even like that night supposed to be going out with his girlfriend, but because this emergency thing comes up, he's got to curtail that and help with this kind of emergency case. Now, even though it's called The Autopsy of Jane Doe, I don't think I expected so much of it to actually be about the autopsy, but it was.
Huh.
I don't mean to say that they're cutting into people every second of this movie, but that is, in fact, strangely, how it unfolds, which is a gross way to think about it because I just said the word unfold.
Yeah.
But they do have a pattern, that a thing that they do, and they talk about how they're going to look at it. And essentially, there are secrets hidden within this autopsy that can only be as you kind of, as they literally cut deeper, they metaphorically cut deeper into the mystery. There's kind of a question as to whether something just really terrible happened, whether something supernatural might have happened. I think it's kind of most fun to like leave that up for people to discover themselves. But it builds pretty intensely. It has some neat twists and turns. It's I think it's what they call like a chamber piece in the sense that it's just really two actors in a fairly isolated area.
Okay.
It's not just this one room. It's the sort of the entire mortuary, but
contained set.
It's a contained set with only, and then one or two other actors coming and going here and there. I didn't quite love it by the end. I thought it had a few problems, but I definitely liked it, and it's got some, it's different enough to recommend to horror fans to check out. Pretty good acting throughout, and some stuff you've probably not ever seen before. So yeah, I'd say recommended.
Cool. All right, that'll be wrapping up for us this week. We'll be back with more next week, and until that time,
Yo Joe.
Thanks for listening. If you like the show, do us a favor and spread the word to your friends, or give us a quick 5-star rating or review on iTunes to help us grow our audience. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or at www.roguesgallerytx.com. We'll be back next week.